Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to Nightmare on Film Street. The current time is 6:66. Traffic is clear ahead from here to the afterlife, but it's hell outside. For the next hour, you're on Nightmare Time. So, let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome back to Nightmare on Film Street, the horror movie podcast for the casually obsessed. I'm John.
I'm Kimmy. And this week, we sat down with author Paul Tremblay to chat his brand new novel called Horror Movie, a Novel.
Paul Tremblay, you probably recognize the name already. He's the author who penned Cabin at the End of the World, which M. Night Shyamalan adapted into Knock at the Cabin. He also wrote Head Full of Ghosts, which is hopefully still one day going to become a movie. We're all waiting for it. It's been optioned forever. There's always news about it. It keeps like, oh, we're making a few steps forward. It's always on the horizon.
Paul has always merged his love of horror movies into his fiction, and Horror Movie, a Novel, surprise, surprise, is no different. So we wanted to sit down with Paul and chat the novel because of, you know, our love of horror movies and horror fiction.
And something really interesting that he brought up in the interview, which I never would have thought, is that he was never really a big reader or writer. He was, like us, just sort of like really big into horror movies. He was more of a mathematics major than anything else, and just sort of like late in life discovered that he's a dope horror fiction writer.
And also a scaredy cat, which as a fellow scaredy cat, I totally appreciate.
Yeah, I think you're going to love this interview. It's really fun. We talk about, you know, horror movies in general and just sort of like the ins and outs of how he approaches a story, how you craft a scare for a book rather than a scare for a movie. And we also delve a little bit into his foray into Hollywood, trying to develop and adapt his own novels into features. Well, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to join us in the podcast today, man.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. So happy to be here.
Like, real quick, I know everybody's definitely familiar with your name. Can you tell us a little bit, the listeners, a little bit about your new book, Horror Movie?
Yeah, well, I mean, in French Canada especially, there's a lot of Tremblay or Tremblays around. Yeah, so I'm the author of a whole bunch of books, including A Head Full of Ghosts, The Cabin at the End of the World, which was made adapted by M. Night Shyamalan to the movie Knock at the Cabin. And I have a movie, depending on when this podcast is coming out, so I'll just say, and a movie, sorry, a book called Horror Movie, coming out on June 11th.
And can you just tell us a little bit about what Horror Movie is?
Yeah, I'm so bad at like the quick elevator pitch, so bear with me. So it is sort of a riff on like the cursed movie sort of trope of horror. So in 1993... these 20-somethings made sort of a low-budget art house disturbing horror movie, which is impretentious, my favorite kind. something happened at the end of filming that prevented it from going to screen. And so now, 30 years later, Hollywood's trying to do a big sort of, or a studio reboot of it. So the book itself is narrated by a man who played the character called the Thin Kid in the original movie. He's never named. He's only refers to himself as the Thin Kid. And it's really sort of presented as the audiobook of him talking about the experience of being on set 30 years ago, what had happened, also what happened in the years in between, Because in the years in between, the director, before she passed away in like 2008, you know, life illness, this isn't like a big shocker. You know, she posted just a couple of scenes to YouTube in 2008, and she posted the screenplay. And this movie sort of, that never was, sort of like Jodorowsky's Dune, weirdly got this huge fan base. Yeah, and hopefully, you know, the fun part for me writing it, hopefully one of the fun parts for the reader too, is I include the whole screenplay of the original movie, like broken up in pieces into the body of the novel. So like I said, I can't tell the short elevator pitch, but that's it.
That's really cool though. And I love that not only is the subject meta, like you're doing kind of a meta horror movie take, but the fact that you're doing different mediums within the book. How was it being predominantly a horror author trying to do the screenplay format? Because that's way different than fiction. It's a less is more medium, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, part of it, like, it starts, honestly, it starts off with me, like a little logic experiment. When I say it, like books or stories, and I knew I was going to bounce back and forth between modern day and in the past. I was like, well, I need to tell the reader about the whole movie, but I just didn't want to like dryly, like, hey, this is what happened in the movie. So like, oh, I'll include the original screenplay. And then one of the characters writes it, and very upfront, she says, you know, she writes it in such a way that most studios and Hollywood screenwriters would like puke at, because she breaks all the rules. I mean, it follows most of the rules sometimes, but other times it doesn't, you know, sort of to serve the story, but also because it was just this really weird movie too. So part of it was fun. I've been trying to dip my toes into screenwriting the last few years, you know, nothing super major. You know, as a novelist, it's funny, I bristle sort of at the idea of everything must have three acts and there's got to be story beats here. I'm like, hey, have you ever watched, you know, Korean or Japanese horror movies where they have like five, six acts? I don't know. Yeah. So in the book is actually some of my, the thin kid sort of slyly comments on like his experience with producers and the like. And it definitely sort of takes my Hollywood experience and satirizes it a little bit.
I was going to ask, yeah, like it, just given the context of the book and, you know, how much we're all still waiting to see Head Full of Ghosts.
Don't ask any haterade questions.
No, these aren't haterade questions. I'm just, you know, I was curious if the thin kid was more or less an extension of you and stuff you dealt with in Hollywood. Sounds like that's a yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's like some things I experienced directly, but also like some other novelists. I mean, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, like, you know, the more I've been in sort of, you know, more of an experienced Hollywood stuff. I mean, that's not just Knock at the Cabin, but like A Head Full of Ghosts was first optioned in 2015. So I've had things optioned and not make it and optioned again and blah, blah, blah. You know,
we've been waiting for, we've been waiting for it forever.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had like a lot of cool conversations with, you know, very, you know, nice and smart producers, but I've also had some like very strange conversations with producers that I'm not sure like how they have their job. So I definitely sort of throw those in there too. But again, also the experience of some novelists like that I've heard just horror stories, not like, like real life horror stories about how they're treated by studios. And, you know, we novelists don't have, we don't have a union. So our only fallback is to fictionalize it for our revenge.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure it's difficult too, navigating, like, if something's been optioned and then it's off the table for you to sell it to anybody else and then there's nothing moving on it, then it's just like, well, you've been holding my book hostage and I would like it to do things.
Yeah. No, there's definitely a lot of, you know, hurry up and wait. But honestly, I mean, to me, that's like the least frustrating part. Some of it, a lot of it is like you'll talk to, you know, sometimes in the past I've gone out like just on like all these like pitch meetings just as like a get to know you. And, you know, these people will be so enthusiastic and you'd be like, wow, I think that really went well. And then you never hear from them again. You know, it's just like ghosting seems like the operating procedure out there. It's so bizarre. Like, I don't know. I'm an adult. You can just say no, not interested. It's not a big deal. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a strange place.
Did you treat horror movie when you were writing it more like a movie or more like a book?
I kind of tried to do both, if that makes sense. So like, you know, which I'm sure maybe we'll talk about, like, I mean, I came to reading much later than most writers. Like, I didn't really fall in love with reading until like my early 20s. So, you know, I was a math major in college, even went to grad school for math. And when I was in grad school, that's when I just started reading like all the Stephen King and Clive Barker and Shirley Jackson. So my first, you know, outside of school, my first exposure to story was all film and TV, like from age 5 to 20, whatever, 21, 22. So, you know, in the 20 plus years since, you know, I've been playing catch up, you know, I definitely read more books than I watch movies now. I tend to read, you know, since like the late 90s, I've been reading like between 60 and 80 books a year.
Wow.
So it was kind of fun to sort of look at those, you know, as a novelist, like sort of look and try to take apart like how a horror movie works, how, you know, hopefully, yeah, how does it make you feel? Mm-hmm. And also vice versa. How could a horror movie make it feel like a book a little bit? You know, because obviously they're so different. Like reading a book is a much more active experience for the reader, right? Because you have to do a lot of the work. And most movies, it's, you know, it's passive. Like it's all on their screen for you. Now, obviously there are exceptions. You know, there are movies that demand your imagination, or like they show enough, but not, they don't show everything. So your imagination is still sort of firing, you know, like Jaws or Texas Chainsaw Massacre. To me, the reason why those two movies are so special, because it does sort of make you be more active as a viewer. So yeah. Anyway, sorry, that's a long rambly answer.
No, rambly. That's totally fine. It's interesting to hear that you were sort of like a late bloomer in that sense, or that you think of yourself as a late bloomer. Like, were you the kind of kid that always had like a good story though? Like, is storytelling something that was, no, not at all?
No, I had no designs, no, like if you had told me when I was like at any of those ages between 5 and 20 that I was going to be writing books, I would have told you were fucking crazy. Can I swear? Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
what,
no,
what
a like
pivot,
I mean
though. From math to horror fiction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it was like, yeah, like so many of us as an adult, like, I mean, I had a hard time in high school just socially, you know, I was super skinny and I also had like a curved spine, so I never felt like really comfortable in high school. And then like when I went to college, it was a really great experience and I fell in love with punk music. And I don't know, it was sort of like the thing was like I felt more confident, more myself. And there was the realization, it's like, oh, it's okay to actually like things, you know, and show off your passions. And so I tried playing music, and the same thing happened with writing. I was like, oh, like I love how that makes me feel. Like, and I just had this weird urge to try it.
That's great.
And unfortunately, I figured out I was a better writer than musician, so I stuck with the writing part of it. But I've been a horror fan, and I've been a scaredy cat for as long as I can remember.
Yes, power to the
scaredy
cats.
So I mean, that's
cats.
Always been there. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're definitely.
Yeah, I just wrote like on the Barnes & Noble's blog. I just wrote. They posted a little essay. It's called "Confessions of a Scaredy Cat" that just came out today. Today being June. What date is it? June 5th.
Yeah.
Right on.
That's cool.
I'm gonna check that out later today.
Yeah.
And so do you think, like, how, you know, come approaching this as a film fan first and then becoming a writer, what is it that you think books do better than movies?
That's a great question. So, I mean, to me, it kind of goes, you know, thinking about it, it goes back to like the idea of being that active participant. Now, obviously, just like in terms of structure, books can get way more interior, right? Like you can get into people's thoughts.
You're not limited by 90 pages.
Right. Yeah. Not limited by 90 pages. I mean, although like I say that, but I don't head jump very often. Like a lot of my books are first person. This book is sort of first person, although, you know, weirdly, the screenplay does more, a little bit more of like the jumping kind of thing and the purpose of this book. For me, like I kind of focused on like the affect or effect, either one, whichever one makes more sense of the book compared to the novel. Like for me as a reader, like I'm very, you know, unless I'm reading at night, like in my bedroom, there are things that'll be too scary. It's like, you know, I'm going to read this tomorrow during the daylight. But like, you know, like when I'm watching a movie in the moment, it's so visceral. I'll be scared, obviously. Where in a book, for me, the effect is more of like this lingering dread where I just find myself thinking about these things, you know, later at weird times. It's just like, it feels like this lived in thing. Because, you know, for some books, like recently Mariana Enriquez's Our Share of Night, you know, it's like an 800 page book. That's something you live in for 2 weeks, as opposed to the 90 minutes or 2 hours. You know, so I mean, there are just even on that sort of level, those two different affects. And, you know, and I find it fascinating. Like, it's kind of hard to put into words, you know, which is why I wrote a book. So hopefully, like, hey, I can't explain it. This book sort of feels like, you know, what both books and movies sort of feel like, horror movies and horror books.
Yeah, hard to pin down in an elevator pitch, but easier to do over 400 pages or anything. Yeah.
Okay, so set in the 90s, it's kind of a meta horror movie. Is it taking a lot of inspiration from the Blair Witch Project?
No. I would say subconsciously. That's one of my favorite movies. You know, it's more a little bit cruel in a way. yeah, because I don't want to give away too much. I mean, I'll say this, though. Like, the book's idea started with another writer friend, Stephen Graham Jones. If you've read Stephen, but you know, he writes amazing books. He's like, hey, you know, my friend Walter's doing this. This was during the the teeth of the pandemic, I should say. He was watching film critic Walter Chow was hosting afternoon matinees through the Denver Public Library, but online. So he'd watch a movie. Most of the time was a horror. Well, not most of the time, but a bunch of the time was a horror movie. And then afterwards, he would talk to somebody really cool about the movie, sometimes the film's director or someone who acted in it, something like that. But anyway, so the first YouTube one I watched was Walter and John Darnielle, who's in The Mountain Goats, but also writes novels, talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I don't know. It was so much fun to watch these two really smart people just talk about the movie. And it sent me into like a Texas Chainsaw rabbit hole. Okay. You know, that was a movie I avoided as a kid because it was so, its reputation was like, so this is like the goriest movie that you'd sit through. And then like I watched it for the first time, probably in my early 30s. You know, obviously it's not gory. It's really like compared to most stuff, it's not gory at all, but it's got such a power and tone. And so, yeah, like I just started doing thinking chainsaw things, and I read, or I should say, I listened to the audiobook of Gunnar Hansen's Chainsaw Confidential.
Oh, yeah.
Which it's really hard to find in print, but it's on Audible. And it's, man, it's really wonderful. Like, and he sort of narrates it with like a wink, like that he'll talk about how sometimes there's a blurred line between him and Leatherface, but just like the spirit of this collaboration of all these people working on this movie where, you know, they didn't know if it was going to work. They didn't know if it was make any money, you know, so financially they were all taking a risk, but they were also physically taking risks because it sounded super dangerous.
Yeah.
What they were doing with the chainsaw. So all of that sort of became, okay, you know, I'm going to have these people making sort of a dangerous, quote unquote, dangerous movie in 1993. And, you know, and I picked that year partly because, I mean, that's when I was in my early 20s, but also I couldn't go back to the 70s because the thin kid character would be too old to be part of the reboot now, sort of thing.
Yeah,
the reboot era.
Yeah. yeah. But, you know, putting in the 90s also, you know, helps set the tone, very, you know, sort of Gen X approach to these directors and actors and stuff like that. And then it all just sort of started spooling out.
That's great. I like, there are so many great stories about, you know, indie filmmakers making movies, and it's just like, wow, this could have gone wrong at any minute. And your approach was basically just like, oh, what if it did? What if it really went wrong?
Right.
No, I love that. Yeah. And you do, like, your books have always like been a little meta in how they're sort of playing with the real world in a fictional space. This one sounds like it has a little bit more commentary on how New Hollywood is always spinning tragedy or even just existing properties. Mm-hmm. Do you find that if we were to read between the lines, it's equal parts film criticism as it is fictional storytelling?
Maybe. I mean, a little bit. Maybe I think it might just be more like a deep look into what is a horror story, like what makes it work, what are the lines you're willing to cross, and how necessary are those lines? Mm. And I think that applies to all art, not just horror. You know, because I really like the idea of these, you know, 20-somethings, you know, trying to make this piece of art, you know, and they weren't in it for the money. Obviously, they'd be happy if it did make money, but they, you know, they were making it because they really wanted to make it. They wanted to say this thing, even if they didn't know what exactly it was they were saying. And I'm, especially as a writer, because I haven't been on a film set. I mean, I have. But I have been a part of like what's going on. You know, I was there observing. Like I got to go to the Knock at the Cabin set for a couple of days. Right. And I just found it really fascinating as someone, you know, who just writes a novel and basically maybe a couple of friends and first readers see it and my editor. But like pretty much it's, you know, rest of it, it's me making all the decisions. Fascinated by the collaborative part of it, especially in the sort of independent filmmaking case where everyone has a stake, you know, beyond obviously you're going to get paid for it. But like everyone's got a personal stake in this thing. And where's this line, especially in this movie or a movie like Chainsaw or something else? You know, there's a line somewhere where like the movie becomes more important to them than the individuals making it. Like when those decisions start sort of getting dangerous. I mean, you can see that all over the place, like the state governments, you know, things like that, where like the collective will sort of takes over the individuals. But like in a movie, it's really sort of this small group, and it's kind of fun to see, you know, for the purposes of a horror story, where that line is.
Yeah, and so like horror is, as a genre, always seems to be about sort of like building a line and then crossing it. Is that something that you approach in developing your own stories? Like, do you decide like if there's a comfortability for yourself that you're trying to push past?
For my stories, most definitely. I mean, listen, if someone were to pay me to write the novelization of Evil Dead 2, I would be there in a heartbeat.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, although I think, you know, there's still lines that movie crosses too. But I mean, the cool part, the fun part is there's so many different ways to write and tell horror stories. You know, I certainly would not prescribe to be like, hey, this is the way you have to do it. You know, especially with so many, you know, previously marginalized voices or currently marginalized voices getting, you know, telling their stories. And, you know, and often it's about overcoming or maybe even a little bit of revenge, which is great. You know, for me, the things that really sort of draw me to the laptop are the stories that do like feel dangerous and real, and usually in a sad bummer way. But I weirdly take hope from that, like, oh, just like there's the recognition that, oh, like there's something terribly wrong, and there's a recognition between the writer and the reader that there's something terribly wrong. Even if it's like a bummer, I find that part of it to be kind of a hopeful thing.
That's funny, yeah, because like I'm just immediately thinking like, oh yeah, so many of your stories that I've read already are just like, oh, what if your whole family almost died or might die? And this is like, what if all your friends and your entire art project got destroyed?
Okay, a little less depressing.
I was thinking maybe we should reset a little.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, so as a scaredy cat, how do you approach writing horror sequences? Like, how do you balance doing the narrative and also making it a horror novel, making it scary?
That's a great question. I mean, some of it, honestly, I just go by feel. You know, the part that I don't think about, which might seem a little counterintuitive, is that I don't think about what's scary, because I have no idea. I think what's scary is so subjective. Mm. Right? I think you can just really get lost in thinking, oh, this is scary, and I think that can lead to, like, cliches and jump scares, whatever the book equivalent of a jump scare is. I don't know. Actually, I've always threatened my poor publisher, because I always put them through hard work with the design part, like either doing like no end notes or like in this case a script. I said, hey, at some point we're gonna have to do like a pop-up page. They're like, no. But yeah, so I was saying, I try not to think about, hey, is this scary? I really try to think about, hey, is this disturbing? I think that's more universal. Does this move the reader? You know, and if it's scary to me, you know, the hope is that it'll be scary to other people too. But like the ultimate question for me every time is like, by the time I get to the end of the book, you know, and I certainly can and could be wrong, or can be wrong. I'm sure I've been wrong plenty of times, but like, it's got to go out. If I can't explain to myself why this thing isn't there, whether it's like a set piece that could be scary or this character decision or things like that. Yeah, and I just, my guiding line is like, is this something I would want to read? You know, again, just the trust that there are other weirdos like me out there who'd want to read it too.
No, I think it's a great idea.
So you don't have any like rules for yourself, like, you know, every chapter needs at least something scary, or I need to make sure that I'm scaring everybody every 10 pages or...
No, in fact, I kind of like really, in the book, it's funny, my character sort of rails against that idea a couple times in the book. But, you know, I mean, because I don't think every story doesn't need that. Like, I think I love stories where there's this giant, like, unimaginably tense buildup to, like, one big thing that explodes at, like, the two-thirds point. Or you can have the thing where it's just, like, you know, stuff's happening every however many pages. I think I think it's just, I think it's wrong to assume, hey, every horror movie, you know, has to have a scare every 10 pages. Because I do hear screenwriters, some big ones, talk like that. And I don't know, that just makes me makes me shake my head. Like, it's like, no, like, it's what the story needs. Like, you got to serve the story.
Yep.
Yeah. That's probably great pushback for your character in the movie coming up against like the modern sequel, requel, reboot world, because in that period between, you know, 1993 and now, not just horror cinema, but cinema in general has become so like formulaic and very structured. Yeah. Like, you know, this has to happen on minute 12 and this has to happen on minute 28 and this has to happen at minute 45. If that's something that the character's like, no, we're not going to do scares so often, whatever. That would be such a good pushback moment for them with modern horror.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's other exceptions too, but like with the exception of like Jordan Peele, whose movies I adore, like that. In the last 20 years, I'd have a hard time coming up with like lists of studio movies that I really love. Or, I mean, maybe the other way of saying it, like if I were to pick my top 10, you know, Jordan Peele's movies would be there, but the rest of the movies would be stuff from other countries or independent, you know, indie studios, A24, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
People are breaking the mold.
Those feel more real.
Yeah.
Those feel more dangerous to me. And weirdly more real. Like, I mean, I'm definitely drawn to things that feel like this could really happen, that the sort of intrusion of, if there's supernatural, the intrusion of supernatural feels weird and hard to identify. I mean, to me, I feel like that would be realistic. If something were supernatural to happen in my life, I'd have a hard time identifying it. And I'd be scared by it, but I'd probably instantly try to explain it away kind of thing. And it would be like really subtle, but something that would like linger. So I don't know, the movies that sort of get that effect are the ones that like stick with me. Something like Lake Mungo.
Oh yeah.
Movie. I'm unhealthily obsessed with Lake Mungo.
Yeah, we actually talked about that movie last year and we hadn't watched it in a while and we were both just so like bummed out by the end of it. It was like watching Fire Walk with Me. It was just so sad.
Yeah. For sure.
So your characters in the book, who seem to have very strong opinions about Hollywood, what are some of their favorite movies?
Would they be the same as your personal favorites?
Yeah. So the thin kid is the one who's telling us most of the story. Although the screenplay is written by a character named Cleo, and Cleo and Valentina are two friends from high school. You know, they've graduated college now. And they're the ones behind the movie. Valentina's the director. She's got the funding. And she's very sort of strong-willed, almost a little bit rude at times. But, like, you know, this is her thing. She's going to make this come hell or high water.
Yeah.
You know, Cleo's a lot more soft-spoken, but she wrote the weirdest screenplay ever. and she is probably more the horror fan than Valentina is. Like, you know, and one of the blurred lines in the book is that in the screenplay, all the characters and the actors are Valentina and Cleo and this other kid, Carson. Like, all the actors are using their same names.
Okay.
So it becomes a question of, well, how much of the screenplay characters is it actually, are these characters in real life? And because you're reading it, like, quote unquote, seeing it in front of your head too, you sort of, it's easy to like say, oh yeah, the character is sort of who's playing them. But anyway, Cleo is the big horror fan. Like in her bedroom and in the screenplay, it's described as she has all these horror movie posters, but they're turned around for pretentious purposes in the movie. eventually she starts revealing them, you know, and she talks about how like she doesn't really like most of these movies, but the ones that she likes, she really likes. I think that kind of describes me a little bit.
It really seems like you put yourself into this book quite a lot. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think every writer, filmmaker, you know, puts pieces of themselves. There is a lot of me in here too, but also there's a lot less of me than the previous book, which was kind of fun. I mean, it was kind of like the thin kid in some ways, I guess, is, you know, when he's sort of being cynical and snarky, I guess that's the part of me I don't let out very often. So that was kind of fun just to sort of lean into that side of it.
That's great. So what's your routine like, especially given that you have so many different voices? Like, do you have like sort of a ritual depending on what character you're writing at that time?
Yeah, no ritual. I mean, I've been a full-time high school math teacher and a writer for, you know, as long as I've been. When I started teaching, I started writing. They've weirdly been like interconnected. So, you know, if I just can squeeze an hour out of the work week, I mean, out of a day, each day per work week, if I find an hour, I'm just going to sit and write. Weekends and obviously time off, I can do a lot more. Mm-hmm. I was able to take a year off a year sabbatical because of the movie Knock at the Cabin. And actually, that's when I wrote most of Horror Movie. I started in the spring when it was sort of my last year before the year off, and then I finished it in my year off. So actually, I don't know. I mean, I feel like maybe that certainly helped the novel, because I could just spend like every day, get up and work like 3 hours on it kind of thing, mm-hmm. Which I never really had the opportunity to do before with other books. So otherwise, no real special rituals. You know, maybe the closest thing that comes to rituals, like I usually change notebooks. Like I've got all these little notebooks around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll get one, and maybe sometimes I'll do two or three things in it, but that's like the notebook that I use for like a project or not.
I mean, that makes sense. It's just like organizing your thoughts. You don't have to worry about having something else in there. And it'll be a lot easier later on when you want to just Xerox them and publish them. You don't have to, have to divide the pages out.
How do your students feel about you as a horror author? Did they all go crazy when M. Night Shyamalan made a movie of your book?
Yeah, so I don't regret taking the year off, but like, so I wasn't in school. I wasn't in school when I could even announce the movie. Mm. Like I started telling some people that it was happening, but like I wasn't there for like, oh, it's being made. And then it came out. Like I went and visited, like, but that wasn't the same as like being in the classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I came back this September, you know, I've got a Knock at the Cabin poster on the wall. One of the few that actually has my title credit on it.
Right.
So I don't know. Like, it's funny. Like, I get asked all the time, do your students read your books? I'm like, I don't know. Like,
they're teenagers.
They wouldn't tell me.
Not the kids in my class. They don't say much. I mean, you know, they're certainly interested in sort of the Hollywood side of things. But, you know, I'm their math teacher in the day to day. So, like, I've made this joke many times before. But, like, in my lowest moments, I'm not above telling the students when they're giving me crap. Like, hey, outside of here, people actually think I'm cool. They're like, no.
Man, teenagers suck. Like we were all the same way. Like we gave zero shits about our teachers. If you saw your teacher in public, you're like, oh shit, I gotta get out of here.
Yeah. Well, I will say when I did a screening that was local to my, like I did a Q&A at a screening that was close to where my school was, and like 8 or 9 former students came to that. That was pretty cool.
Oh, that's fun.
That's all right. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
And so is there a subgenre that you haven't worked in yet that you're like really excited to do, or something maybe you're even scared to do that you think is beyond your reach?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty. Like, I've never done a werewolf story, but I am afraid to do that because when it's done well, it's like, oh, I don't need to, you know, they already did this. This is great. So I don't know. Like maybe someday I'd like to attack. Because, I mean, it's a very short list of werewolf movies that I like, like American Werewolf in London, Ginger Snaps, Howling, and spacing on Marvel's movie, Dog Soldiers, right?
Oh, yeah.
And on the book side of things, recently, you know, Stephen Graham Jones wrote Mongrels, which is just genius, and Rachel Harrison had one come out a couple of years ago called Such Sharp Teeth that, like, those two books make me feel like, okay, I don't really need to do a werewolf novel because I'm not going to approach those books. And I've always wanted to write like a giant monster novel too, but I've written so many like short stories recently and a novella featuring a giant monster. I think I've covered that. So I don't know. Like I tend to go from story to book to book. I don't have like a bullpen of ideas waiting for me, which is a little scary too, but you know, just hopefully when I finish whatever I'm working on next, there'll be something else there too to start.
That's cool. That's awesome. So
thanks.
For anybody that's new into like getting into horror fiction, maybe they were more into film and they're just starting to get into horror fiction, other than your stuff, what should they be checking out? What would appeal the modern horror fan?
Okay, so you know, I've already mentioned Steven. Like if you're a slasher fan, which I know so many people are, you should definitely, he just finished a trilogy of slasher novels. The first one was called My Heart is a Chainsaw. Second one was Don't Fear the Reaper. And then this February, he just finished it with The Angel of Indian Lake. So, I mean, I can't imagine if you're a slasher fan, like that you would, I can't imagine that you would not like just love those novels. And actually he's so prolific. He has another novel that's so much fun coming out this summer called I Was a Teenage Slasher. Right. And it's from the first person point of view of this teenager. I mean, it's not a spoiler because it's in the title.
Sort
of becomes a slasher. But again, it's very meta, very strange. Again, if you're someone who's grown up on slasher movies, yeah, that's probably the book for you as well. I don't know, elsewhere, there are just so many other like great, relatively newer horror writers that are just doing such amazing stuff. One of my favorites, as I mentioned, is Mariana Enriquez. Her novel, like if you want a big doorstop that's just going to take over your life, Our Share of Night, I've already read it twice, even though it's only been published like in the last 2 years.
Wow.
And she has a short story collection coming out later this summer. So I don't want to just like read a list of names. So, you know, John Langan, The Fisherman, I think is a classic that anyone should read. So yeah, let's stop with those three.
That's great.
That's great. That's awesome. Like we're way more into, we just have more time for movies than we have for books, which is a bummer. Mm-hmm. I used to read so much. I basically did the reverse of you. Like I just like was a voracious reader and then I got into movies and now it's like I read a handful of books a year at best.
Films do have the convenience that you get the whole narrative in under 2 hours.
But yeah, I'm always, it's so hard to try and find good recommendations. So I'm definitely going to be checking these out.
What I would also say, like, obviously I don't want to bring listeners away from this podcast. You got to listen to this podcast first, but you know, if you're shy, you could certainly audiobooks. And the cool thing about recent audiobooks is a lot of them are really going like, not obviously over the top, that's not the right phrase, but I'm going to use it for now, on their audiobook production. You know, for example, like Stephen's most recent, the third book in his trilogy, for a brief snippet, they actually got Stephen King to read as one of the characters Angel of Indian Lake. Yeah. And with my horror movie, if you don't mind me plugging.
No, go for it.
That's what you're here to do.
So the audiobook has got multiple readers. You've got the reader for The Thin Kid, the reader for, you know, the screenplay. But after each section of the screenplay, they're going to, you know, they're going to read it like it is in the book, but then they're going to take a little break and do like a dramatic table reading of the screenplay sections. With all sorts of multiple readers. So yeah, so a lot of, you know, publishers these days are getting really creative with the audiobook presentation, which is a lot of fun.
That's great. And that's nearly right. Everybody's got a commute, so audiobooks are perfect.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I've started diving back into audiobooks because, yeah, I'm just like, okay, so what? I don't take the bus anymore. I can't read. I think I've just had a bit of a stigma about audiobooks. I'm like, no, I want to read the book, but audiobooks are great. Like, I've been loving them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, like, that's how I sneak in extra reads. Like, for, you know, I was walking the dog. I could listen to audiobook or, like you said, commute to school and whatnot.
And I know Kim prepped you on this question. We like to ask everybody who comes on the podcast what their dream double feature would be at the drive-in. If you could program any two movies at a drive-in, what would you play?
Oh, and I know I didn't do my homework. Although, like, I will say I'm going to give you a couple because I got to a couple of years ago, I was invited down to Houston for an Alamo House down there that had, like, it was called Graveyard Shift, series of horror films every few weekends. So they had me program it wasn't a drive-in, but they had me, let me program a double feature.
That's fun.
You know, and
that's
get great. Up and sort of introduce each movie. So we already talked about one of them, but the first movie was 1999's Ravenous with Guy Pearce.
Oh yeah.
I love that movie. I think it's even better now. Like, it's, I think what it sort of says about what's happening politically now is even more sort of relevant to what it was in 1999. It's so quirky. I love movies that shift tones and do weird things with tone. And I wrote like three novels to the soundtrack of that movie.
Oh, wow.
It's really hard to find now. Like, it's not on any of the streamers. It's a bummer.
Aww.
It's only on YouTube, the full soundtrack.
Huh.
That was a minimalist composer plus Daniel Nybarn. Nybarn? Nybarn? The dude from Gorillaz?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I actually have the CD, but I have nothing near my computer that can play it anymore.
Oh.
So anyway, yeah. So I did Ravenous. We did Ravenous first and Lake Mungo second. So that was sort of like a fun double bill. If I were to do one now, I would lean into maybe some older movies. How about like 1954's Them?
Okay.
I think anyone under like 35 probably hasn't seen Them, and it's so good. It holds up so well.
Yeah.
It's a great drive-in movie.
Yeah. And I heard they might be remaking it. I'm going to do another older movie too. We'll do two old movies. And Quatermass in the Pit, although in the US it was called, what, 5 Million Years to Earth?
All of those Quatermass movies got different titles, right? Like, there's the Creeping Death or something was the other one. I can't remember.
I mean, that's a good title.
Yeah. So, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, like, you know, some of the effects in that movie don't hold up, like the, with a little bit of spoiler, sort of the alien bodies they find look like they're made out of like paper mache.
Yeah.
But the story and the acting is amazing, and the plots. If you've seen, you know, Carpenter's, oh my God, why am I space on the name? What was the movie? The Green Slime?
Prince of Darkness, right?
Darkness.
Yeah.
The what?
Prince of Darkness.
Prince of Darkness, yeah. I mean, even in the credits of that movie, like, there's a cheeky little credit to Quatermass because some of the ideas in that movie are, you know, reference Quatermass in the Pit. You know, and one of the terrible recent alien movies was a Prometheus. sort of takes a little bit, which is fine. Like, I take from everything from that movie too. But I was like, I would love more people to watch that original.
That's cool. That's a great, like, really I love good. A classic horror drive-in double feature.
Hell yeah.
And about the effects not holding up, like, they're fine with through a dirty windshield.
There you go.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that way you can bring the kids and they won't be terrified. Maybe they'll be bored, but.
That's actually not a bad plan, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Where can people get horror movie?
So, starting Tuesday, June 11th, you know, hopefully in any bookstore that's near you. Any good one. But yeah, otherwise, you know, you can order it online from the usual suspects. I will say Barnes & Noble is also publishing sort of like an exclusive edition as well. Where it,
right on.
Like I wrote like a 15-page liner notes, like the writing of the book, like, you know, how I did what I did, you know, some of the references. And also they had me include a second essay of, I gave a list of, I couldn't call them cursed movies or lost movies, because it was like, well, if I've seen it, it's not really lost. Yeah. I call them underappreciated movies. So I have a list of, like a little essay of list of what I think are some unappreciated movies.
That's cool. And everybody get the hard copy. The first edition has blood on the edge of the pages.
Hell yeah.
Blood, that's right. I was going to show up, but we're not in a video. Yeah. The first...
quote unquote blood.
Yeah, the first edition has sprayed red edges, which is fun.
That's cool. Awesome. Thank you so much to Paul Tremblay for sitting down and chatting with us. We had such a blast. Please check out Horror Movie, a Novel. It is out everywhere. You can get it wherever books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, if you're in Canada, Chapters Indigo.
Yeah, if you got a small little independent bookshop near you, especially one maybe that specializes in horror, give them your support. Check out the book. Pick up a copy for yourself. Sounds like a perfect summer read. It sounds like found fiction in a novel.
Found fiction is a great subgenre name.
That was a complete slip, and I'm sticking with it. Anyway, we'll be back again next week with another episode of Nightmare on Film Street. But until then, I'm John.
I'm Kimmy.
Stay creepy.
It appears you made it out alive. But we'll get you next time. Help us to grow the horde. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. More terror can be found lurking on our website, nofspodcast.com. Until next time, stay creepy, fiends.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.